Okay. It's been a while since I was preaching. And maybe you didn't notice, and that's okay. But it was great to have Pastor Samuel, and then we had Evangeline. And so maybe I'm a little rusty coming up after 4 weeks of not preaching. But we are going to start a new series that will last to the end of summer. And it's not some great theological treatise or some deep kind of discourse that we're going to be looking at. We're actually going to be looking at ordinary things. I'm convinced that the only way to really grow as a disciple of Jesus is to find God in the mundane. Because I think that for most of us, most of our lives are pretty ordinary. There's extraordinary moments from time to time, and maybe your life is extraordinary all the time. Maybe you have that attitude, and that's fantastic. For me, I find a lot of the time is fairly mundane. You know the things that we post on Facebook? That's like the highlight reel. We do that, right? Chrissy and I were on an adventure on our motorcycles. We went into Idaho and we came up through Montana. We were camping. We were doing all kinds of crazy things. And we post the highlight reels. What we don't post is the long stretches of prairie road where nothing happens. And it's so boring. And the wind and the sun and the sweat. We don't post that. That's the mundane. And I think that's a lot of our lives is actually pretty ordinary. And if we are to grow as disciples of Jesus, we need to find out how to do that in the mundane of life. So that's what we're going to be looking at over the next few weeks. So I'd like to read for us 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verses 23 to 33 as we begin this journey together. Paul says this to the Corinthians. I have the right to do anything, you say, but not everything is beneficial. I have the right to do anything, but not everything is constructive. No one should seek their own good, but the good of others. That right there is the fundamental statement about Christian freedom. A lot of people calling for freedom, but fundamentally, freedom is not seeking your own good, but the good of others. We are free to love one another, right? Okay, that's not the sermon part. That was an aside. Verse 25. He goes on to give them some instructions about what to do with food sacrificed to idols. He says this. Eat anything sold in the meat market without raising questions of conscience. For the earth is the Lord's and everything in it. And if an unbeliever invites you to a meal and you want to go, eat whatever is put before you without raising questions of conscience. But if someone says to you, this has been offered in sacrifice, then don't eat it, both for the sake of the one who told you and for the sake of conscience. I'm referring to the other person's conscience, not yours. For why is my freedom being judged by another's conscience? If I take part in the meal with thankfulness, why am I denounced because of something I thank God for? So, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God. And do not cause anyone to stumble, whether Jews, Greeks, or the church of God, even as I try to please everyone in every way, for I am not seeking my own good, but the good of many, so that they may be saved. Amen. I think when we think about spirituality or we think about spiritual disciplines, we often think of the classic ones, right? We think of prayer, we think of worship services, Bible reading, maybe fasting, maybe solitude, or perhaps even a mission trip. All these are ways that we express our spirituality. These are all spiritual disciplines, and they are good. But rarely do we think about lunch. Well, I think about lunch all the time, actually, but rarely do you think about food in the sense of spiritual disciplines. But the Bible certainly does. The Bible actually has a lot to say about food. The first chapters of Genesis place humanity in this garden that's overflowing with food. The first mistake is a mistake that's made expressed through food. Jesus' ministry was constantly interrupted with meals. He was either going to a table, coming from the table, or sitting at a table. It was very important in the life of Jesus. And his final meal with his disciples becomes what? the Lord's Supper. We call it the Last Supper sometimes, but it's the Lord's Supper. We celebrate it together, or at least a memory of it. And the Bible ends with a wedding banquet. So you get this theme all throughout Scripture of food. And some of us rejoice, right? Apparently, God cares a great deal about what happens around a table. I've said this before and told some of you, but we have a table in our dining room, and it is old. It's quite rickety. I have to tighten it up every so often, and it's quite badly stained all over, but it's Christine's grandmother's table. And when I think about that, and I think about multiple generations of Christine's family sitting around this table, suddenly this very ordinary table that we probably should have replaced some time ago becomes very precious. God seems to care a lot about what happens around a table. This series that we're doing is called The Sacred Ordinary, and because most of our lives, as I've said, are not lived during extraordinary spiritual moments, they're actually very ordinary. We know that there's 168 hours in every week, right? That's just a fact. If you have more, maybe share some with others. But 168 hours in every week, and many of us gather for worship for perhaps one of those hours. The other 167 hours are spent driving to work, preparing meals, raising children, answering emails, visiting friends, paying bills, folding laundry. You get the idea, right? That's what happens, these other 167 hours. Is God only interested in the 1 hour? No, we know he's not, right? Or does he meet us in the other 167? That's the question we're asking. How do we see God in the 167 all throughout the rest of the week? Well, the Christian calendar, which we're becoming more familiar with as Baptists, right? The Anglicans have it down, and our Catholic friends do, and Orthodox, they have calendars all throughout the year, the Christian calendar, and we tap into it when we want to, right? When it's Easter or when it's Christmas. But the Christian calendar gives an answer to this. While we often celebrate Advent and Christmas, Lent and Easter, sometimes even Pentecost in the Baptist church, although we don't often clap our hands, the majority of the year in the Christian calendar is actually called what? Does anybody know? Ordinary time. Thank you, Nancy Lowe. That's coming from Ron's Catholic background, I think. Ordinary time. Isn't that interesting? And it's called ordinary time not because it's boring or less spiritual. It's called ordinary because it reminds us that most discipleship happens in the ordinary rhythms and the mundane of everyday life. Faith is formed not only in the great celebrations of the church, like Easter and Christmas, but in the daily practices of following Jesus. And so today's ordinary practice is eating. And as Paul says, something surprising, food is never just food, according to the Bible. The passage that we read is actually the conclusion of a fairly complicated argument that stretches across several chapters that Paul gives. The Corinthians had a question. They wanted to know whether Christians could eat meat that had been offered in pagan temples. That's not necessarily a question that we have today, and so we'll have to do a little work to apply the lessons, but that's the question they were asking. And on the surface, it seems like a fairly simple question. But Paul's answer is not very simple. That's typical Paul, isn't it? He has a way of just complicating things enough that we have to do some extra work. So back in chapter 9, Paul argues that Christian freedom is real. This is a really big deal for Paul. We are free from the law. We are free in the Spirit. The Corinthians were saying, we're free to do whatever we want. And Paul says, not quite. Just rein it in. He says, I have rights as an apostle, yet I willingly surrender many of those rights out of love for others. Freedom is governed by love. Freedom, Christian freedom, is not anarchy, says Paul. Christian freedom is governed by love. And so the exercise of one's personal freedom is to be governed by whether the action will actually bring love to each other and glory to God. whether it will build up the church of God, and whether it will encourage those who do not yet know Jesus to come to know Jesus. That's the metric by which Paul measures freedom. And then in chapter 10, as we launch into that, Paul reminds the Corinthians about Israel's experience in the Exodus. They enjoyed all kinds of spiritual privileges. They were rescued, they were fed by God, they were guided by God, yet they still drifted toward idolatry. Blessings do not automatically produce faithfulness. That's an important thing that Paul points out. Then Paul says something fascinating. He says, an idol, in one sense, is absolutely nothing. It's just wood. It's just stone. It's just metal. It has ears, but it can't hear. It has eyes, but it can't see. It has mouth, but it can't talk. It's just wood. It's just metal. It's just stone. It's, in one sense, nothing. Certainly not a god. But then he goes on to say this, and I think this is important. But behind idolatry stand spiritual powers that seek human allegiance. That's what Paul wants to warn the Corinthians about, this idea of allegiance. So knowingly participating in meals that are connected to idol worship wasn't simply eating meat. It was participating in another story, another kingdom, another allegiance. And that's what Paul warns about. So go into the market. Don't ask any questions, says Paul. You know, buy your meat, take it home and eat it. Go to your friend's house, whether they're a believer or not. But as soon as someone says, by the way, this was part of our worship practice today, and you're invited in, then beware. Don't eat it, because it's this call for allegiance. So that's what we want to unpack a little bit today. So three things, of course, briefly, and we're going to look really at the context that we're looking at in Corinthians and then try and apply some principles to our everyday lives. First of all, food, says Paul, reveals loyalties. The Corinthians thought they were simply asking about food. Paul says they're really asking about allegiance. The meal itself wasn't the issue. It's the allegiance behind the meal that is the issue. I think every culture has tables, and every table tells a story. And in Corinth, meals in pagan temples communicated loyalty to the gods of the city. That was the whole point. And if you weren't showing up at the table of Apollo or the table of whatever the particular god was in that city, then you were disloyal. It was like a test of loyalty. And so these meals weren't just meal. This food wasn't just food. It was about allegiance to the powers behind what it represented. Well, today, our idols are perhaps less obvious, aren't they? Sometimes. We rarely bow down to carved statues. If that's your normal habit, I would love to have a conversation with you. But we don't do that very often, do we? But we certainly gather around rival altars in our lives. Maybe it's the altar of consumerism, just a little bit more, right? Maybe it's the altar of our own ambition and become something of an idol that drives us. Maybe it's the altar of comforts. That's the highest priority in our lives, or the altar of entertainment. We could think of a number of different altars. But even food itself can become an idol. Something that we obsess over, something that we find our identity in, or something that we use to cope with anxiety and loneliness. I won't ask for a show of hands, but does anyone find themselves using food from time to time inappropriately? I know that if I'm really stressed and I don't realize that I'm stressed or I'm carrying a lot of anxiety, the telltale sign is when I sit down after supper and Christine opens a bag of Doritos, I will finish the bag. I'm no quitter. I'll get to the bottom of that bag all the way just to prove it. And afterwards, I'll regret it, right? I'll confess my sins, and I'll feel somewhat anxious and sorry. But I realize that when I'm doing that, it's like self-medicating. It's like self-therapy. And I realize that's a mechanism that I'm using. I'm using food to try and curb my anxiety. Maybe some other people do that. And so food itself isn't just food. It tells us a lot about our loyalties. It tells us what our heart is doing. The question isn't merely, what am I eating? The deeper question is, what has my heart attached itself to? And sometimes food can reveal that to us. Food has an amazing ability to expose what we trust in. Do we receive food with gratitude, or do we demand it and expect it with entitlement? Do we consume it mindlessly? Sometimes I do that. Or do we receive it intentionally as a gift from God? This matters in our daily walk with God. Brother Lawrence, some of you have heard that name perhaps. Brother Lawrence, he wasn't a monk, but he worked in a monastery. He worked in the kitchen. And the practice of the presence of God is a little booklet that he wrote. And Brother Lawrence believed that every ordinary task, even preparing supper, could become an expression of love toward God, because every ordinary act presents an opportunity to choose him again. In the ordinary acts of making a meal, of receiving a meal, of enjoying a meal together. And so Paul reminds us that every meal quietly answers the question, whose table am I really sitting at? I loved it when my dad came to faith, when he finally gave his heart to Christ. He was a hard-working man. I've talked about him before. He worked 4 days at the mine, and then he worked 4 days building houses. He had an eight-day week. He was just always, always working. And he was working so that his family could have a better life than what he grew up with in Glasgow in Scotland. And he achieved that. All of my brothers and I, we have very good lives, and in large part, in thanks towards my dad's hard work. But when my dad came to faith in Jesus Christ, something changed in his attitude. Up to that point, he saw himself as a self-made man. But I remember the first time that we prayed together before a meal as a family, and my dad bowed his head and just said, "Everything that is on this table belongs to God." And we paused to give him thanks for it. And that sounds so simple, but it was so revolutionary, because he recognized that even with all of his hard work, that this, what we're about to receive, is a gift from God. Okay, food reveals our loyalties. Food, secondly, forms community. And I think we know this even better than the first point. Meals have always shaped community. The earliest Christians didn't simply attend services together. They broke bread together. Jesus was constantly eating with people. In fact, he got in trouble for it, remember? Why did he get in trouble? Because when he sat at the table of the sinners, people thought he was being loyal to their sin, right? They connected that. Jesus constantly eating with people, tax collectors, Pharisees, friends, strangers, sinners. The risen Christ even restored Peter over breakfast. He made breakfast for him. Meals slow us down enough to become human again if we let them. I think our culture, and I find this true of myself as well, we increasingly eat alone, or maybe in the car, or maybe in front of screens, or maybe just standing at the kitchen counter. Food simply becomes fuel. Efficiency replaces fellowship. And I think we have to consciously fight against that from time to time. That food is just something that we use to keep our body going, when it has the potential to form us into community. Next week, we have the potluck lunch. And it truly is potluck. And if you're not able to bring anything, that's totally fine. There will be food here enough for everyone to share, because food is just the mechanism to help us form community. And that's what we're doing, and that's what food does for us. Paul Stevens, some of you know that name as well. He was my mentor, teacher at Regent College. And he argues that discipleship is learned in ordinary practices. This is what he says. Around the table, we learn gratitude, patience, forgiveness, generosity, listening, and welcome. The kitchen table becomes one of God's classrooms, right? Perhaps one of the most spiritual disciplines available today is simply eating together with other people. Not because the menu is special, but because people are. Some of the greatest meals that I've enjoyed together has just been soup and bread, right? Have you ever done that? But the company around the table is something that you hold on to and is really, really precious. If you were to look at my phone and to look at all the pictures on my phone, which you're welcome to do anytime, I suppose, but you'll find that there's three main categories of pictures, right? One is motorbikes. You'll find a lot of that on there. The second is my dog. You'll find Berkeley everywhere. And the third is random photos of food that my daughter send me constantly. You know this whole trend of posting your breakfast on Instagram or posting a meal? And I thought, this is so ridiculous. It's so strange. But as I've been reflecting on it, it's actually a beautiful tribute to the fact that both our girls appreciate the sacredness of food. There's something about it that's worth capturing. There's some moment there that's worth holding on to. And so it'd be very interesting if I used one of those apps that printed out all the pictures of my phone and put them on the wall. There'd be a lot of shots of plates of food. And that's maybe a good thing as we slow down, as we take it in and realize that food brings us into community. Well, the third and final thing we'll mention is this. Paul points out that food shapes our worship. Paul concludes with one of the broadest commands in the New Testament. Whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God. Notice what he does here. He doesn't move from food to church. He moves from food to worship directly. The ordinary becomes the sacred. For Paul, worship is not confined to the sanctuary. It's extended to a dining room, to a picnic table, to a coffee shop, to your family supper table. Martin Luther, the reformer, he challenged the medieval idea that only monks and priests performed sacred and spiritual work. He insisted that the ordinary vocations of everyday Christians were actually holy callings before God. And the same is true of our ordinary meals. There is no divide between the spiritual and the ordinary. This is all sacred time. Sometimes we just don't realize it or don't be intentional about it. So every meal can become an act of worship when it is received with gratitude, shared with generosity, and offered to the glory of God. Michael Horton wrote a book called Ordinary, and in it he says this, God ordinarily transforms his people through ordinary means faithfully practiced over time. We often long for dramatic spiritual experiences. We want that fresh retreat, that new spiritual high, right? But we realize that God is patiently forming us through daily habits. And one of those habits has to do with food. In the passage that we read, Paul actually quotes from Psalm 24. It says, the earth is the Lord's and everything in it, which is familiar to us. But that was actually part, and is still part, of a Jewish blessing at mealtimes. That's what Paul was pulling out there. It was used to acknowledge that everything belongs to God, but we're not stealing his food. We're actually receiving it as a gift. And that's what we do when we begin with prayer for food. Perhaps that's why Christians have traditionally prayed before meals. Sometimes I think we should probably pray after the meal to make sure it was good and worth praying for. But we're meant to pray before the meal, right? And it's just a simple habit that we do to recognize everything is the Lord's and we receive this from him. And it's not because food magically changes because of our prayer, but we, in fact, change in our perspective because of our prayer. Prayer reorients our hearts, and gratitude reminds us whose world this is. And the table becomes a place of worship. So how do we wrap this up? Well, I'm told the average human in North America will eat around 80,000 meals during their lifetime. I think that's assuming that you're eating three meals a day and that you live to your like 80 or something like that, right? Some of us eat more or less, but that's kind of the average. 80,000 meals in our lifetime. Imagine if those meals became more than just simple routines. Imagine if they became reminders. Reminders that every good gift comes from God. Reminders to gather rather than to isolate. Reminders that every ordinary act can become, in fact, an act of worship. So Paul's concern was never simply meat sacrifice to idols. That was the question. That was part of it. But his concern was that Christians understand that nothing is spiritually neutral. That's so important. Nothing is spiritually neutral. Even eating and drinking shape our hearts. And so we're called to be intentional about it. So what do we do this week? Well, this week, don't simply eat as much as you can. Be intentional about our food. Receive our food with gratitude. Share your table generously with others. Slow down long enough to notice God's presence, because food is never just food. It reveals our loyalties. It forms our community. And ultimately, it shapes our worship. Let's pray together.